Brian Walter. Mr. Walters, along with the other three defendants, Mr. Jeffrey Weiss, Mr. Adam Harris, and Mrs. Alicia Dyson, were involved in a scheme to alter genuine currency. The scheme involved taking genuine $1 bills and $5 bills and soaking them in ammonia until all of the ink was off. Then they would take the blank $1 bill and $5 bills and superimpose the image of a $100 bill onto it through a color printer. The district court sentenced our clients under United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 2B5.1, and that's why we're here today, because the central issue before the court is whether the United States Sentencing Guidelines recognizes a difference between genuine currency, which has been fraudulently altered, and counterfeit currency manufactured or made in its entirety. And in this particular scheme, we contend that the genuine $1 and $5 bills were fraudulently altered. It should be noted that the $5 bills that were altered, they did retain their embedded safety features, such as the watermark of President Lincoln and the security strip located on the left front side. It is our position that the sentencing guidelines does make and differentiates between a genuine but fraudulently altered instrument and one that's been falsely made or manufactured in its entirety. And that distinction is made under application note number 3, found in section 2B5.1. Under the guidelines, only an instrument which is falsely made or manufactured in its entirety is considered counterfeit.
Did the district court make any reference to that application note?
No, the district court did not make reference to application note number 3. It only made reference to application note number 2, which essentially set forth what is a counterfeit bearer obligation.
And had application note 3 been argued and presented to the court?
Yes, Your Honor. It was presented and argued to the court, especially in our written objections that we made to the court with respect to the pre-sentence investigation reports. And what's important about application note number 3 is that it does define what counterfeit means. It states, counterfeit as used in this section, referring to 2B5.1, means an instrument that purports to be genuine but is not because it's been falsely made or manufactured in its entirety. Offenses involving genuine instruments, like what our clients used, had been altered or are covered under Section 2B1.1, and that's the sentencing guideline that the court should have applied in this
counsel,
case.
Of course, the problem that has been raised here that is pointed out to us is that the caption to 2B1.1 specifically says it doesn't apply to counterfeit bearer obligations, and the definition of counterfeit being obligations that have been altered in their entirety. So you have an inconsistency, it seems to me, that we have to work through.
Well, you're looking, I understand the court is looking at the caption of 2B1.1, but in that caption it talks about counterfeit bearer obligations. It does not refer to altered obligations. In fact, the caption talks about altered genuine instruments, and that's why 2B1.1 is applied here, not the counterfeit bearer obligation, which is why application note number 3 becomes so important in reaching the correct decision in this case, the way the court in the 7th and the 11th circuits in United States versus Inklima and United States versus Schreckengost reviewed and reasoned that application note number 3 has to be reviewed in order to determine whether or not 2B5.1 applies or 2B1 applies in the case.
Well, let me make sure I understand your argument here. Under the caption under 2B1, it says offenses involving altered or counterfeit instruments other than counterfeit bearer obligations of the United States. How does 2B1 fit now?
Well, 2B1 would fit in our particular case because we don't have counterfeit obligations. We just have altered genuine instruments that were used in this scheme. A counterfeit bearer obligation, as defined under application number 3, would be an obligation that was made in its entirety. As the court thoroughly explained in United States versus Inkelma, it went through the definition of what altered meant. And the court reasoned through exactly what it meant by manufacturing. That is, taking a piece of paper that absolutely had no value to begin with and was going to be nothing but other than paper and turning it into something else, which was a counterfeit Federal Reserve note. That's what manufactured in its entirety means, as opposed to taking a genuine Federal Reserve note, like our clients used here, and altering them to make them just a fake $100 bill note. But they still maintained their $1 and $5 value.
But do the guidelines, case law under it, have any rule of interpretation? The conflict in 2B1.1 is that the introductory commentary says it does not apply to altered or counterfeit bearer obligations, and then the caption says it doesn't apply to counterfeit bearer obligations. Now, all this would fit fairly well with what your argument says, if not for the introductory commentary to 2B1.1. So do we have established, either in the guidelines themselves or case law, how to read such potential inconsistency together?
Well, I don't know of any case that law at this point that would direct this court on how to resolve that conflict, other than the fact that the basic statutory interpretation should prevail in this case, where the court needs to look at the substantive provisions of these two particular guidelines, as well as the application note that was set forth, number 3, which gives the court the guidance on which way to go. I know that Judge Stagg, in rendering his decision, relied upon the introductory note to Section 2B1, but that note is in direct conflict with the title. So I think in that particular case, that's where the court should not rely upon that conflict and rely upon the more substantive portions of Application Number 3 to provide you with the guidance and reaching the right decision and in reversing the court and sentencing and stating that Section 2B1 is the proper guideline to be applied here. I think it's important for the court to note that you have to read Section 3 in conjunction with Section 2, which the district court did not do in this case. And if the court had done that, then clearly it would have sentenced our clients under the proper guideline, which would have been Section 2B1. The second portion of our appeal also deals with the misapplication of the enhancement provision. The district court erroneously applied the provisions of United States Sentencing Guidelines Section 2B5.1B3 to enhance our client's sentences. The district court failed to apply the precepts of Application Note Number 4. If you review Application Note Number 4, it says in essence the enhancement provision does not apply to persons who produce items that are so obviously counterfeit that they are unlikely to be accepted even if subjected to only minimal scrutiny. In this particular case, I think it's important to note that when Mr. Harris passed the counterfeit $100 bill at McDonald's, the cashier looked at it and then immediately gave it to her manager, and the manager immediately knew it was counterfeit. This wasn't a complex scheme. It wasn't a difficult scheme in which to try to alter these bills to make them look authentic.
But weren't there 4 passings and 2 of them successful?
No, Your Honor. There were 2 passings which were not successful. There was some testimony at the sentencing hearing with regard to a bank turning over these other two counterfeit notes that had the same serial number to the Secret Service, but there was no testimony presented as to whether or not those were actually successful passings, and there was no testimony or evidence presented by the government as to whether or not those notes were actually involved in this particular scheme with our clients. So there were really the most confirmed evidence that there were two passings and neither one of them were successful. In fact, Mr. Harris admitted to Agent Kraft that he tried to pass it at Walmart, and they knew immediately, too, that it was fake. So,
Counsel, getting back to what Judge Smith asked about the first guideline issue, this was presented to the district judge, and a decision was made as to factually as to whether it was sufficient under this guideline or not. Or I think you have an issue as well of whether the right evidence was looked at by the district judge. But isn't this a fact question that we review in the normal way of fact question resolutions?
With regard to the enhancement provision?
Right. Fact question of whether they were so obviously counterfeit is not likely to be accepted by anyone under reasonable even, I forget what the phrase is.
It is scrutiny. A fact question, but the concern that we have is that the court didn't even look at the facts.
Well, he looked at copies of the actual bills, did he not? He didn't look at the actual bills, but he looked, I thought, at photocopies of the bills.
Well, I think the court, when we appeared, and the transcript will bear this out, when we appeared for the sentencing, in essence, in the very beginning, the court let us know that Judge Stagg had already made his decision, and in fact, he states in the beginning of the transcript, I have my memorandum ruling and I will be giving it to you. So the decision as to how he was going to sentence our clients had already been made in advance. While the government did introduce these photocopies, it was at my request that the originals be put in for the court to examine, but the court never examined the original notes. The government didn't even have them there at the time. And I think under U.S. versus Wyjak, that's one of the things that the court should have done, and he didn't. And that's why it should be at least remanded, because the facts in itself were not developed at the sentencing hearing by the court with regard to the physical inspection of the notes.
This was genuine paper, was it not?
Yes, it was genuine paper.
So
but
the copy wasn't good enough to indicate to the sentencing judge as to the quality of the alteration?
I think once a photocopy would give the court an idea, but I think the actual inspection of the note would have been better for the court, because then he would have been able to see what the cashier at McDonald's and the manager at McDonald's saw, and he would have been able to see what the other cashier at Walmart actually saw when they knew immediately that this was counterfeit. So it would have given the court more of that presence than just looking at a photocopy. And the court failed to consider that. And I think that reason is why the enhancement provision in this case was misapplied by the district court.
Was there testimony by agents at the sentencing hearing as to the quality of the notes?
Agent Kraft did testify, and there was some testimony, yes, as to the quality of the note, which he basically, I think, testified that it wasn't I'm not positive what Agent Kraft testified. I do know that there was some testimony to that effect about the quality of the note. I know that Agent Kraft also had testified with respect to these notes that if it was completely bleached, he's not certain, but he did not think that the Treasury Department would have given a new one. But if it had been partially bleached, the note itself probably would have been able to be redeemed for a new one. That testimony was developed. At this point, I have 5 minutes left for rebuttal, so I am going to defer now to Ms. Cassery.
Yes, you saved time for rebuttal. Ms. Cashier?
Good morning, Your Honors. It seems that the major difficulty with this case is, are these altered or are these counterfeit? And I would like to look at the basis for the only two cases which have decided the issue and decided it differently from the way Judge Stagg and then Judge Walter in a previous case decided it. In Clemma, the 11th Circuit looked at the initial original item, $5 bill, and then skipped to the final product and said, oh, this is an altered $5 bill. Eliminated what happened to the item in the process. In Shrek and Ghost, apparently that issue was raised because Shrek and Ghost argues that, well, they started with a $5 bill, and when they bleached it completely, and then looking at a website, they decided that, or surmised or concluded, that the government, the Treasury, would accept a completely bleached out bill before it was reprinted, would accept it and would exchange it for its original face value of $5. Under that circumstance, then, when the defendants printed on it, they were printing on an altered bill that still maintained its value, and they were simply altering it. Judge Stagg looked at every point in the process and determined, based on testimony from Agent Kraft, that you start off with a $5 bill, but once you bleach it, it has lost its value as a Federal Reserve note and will not be accepted.
You still have the paper and the watermark, though, don't you?
You still have the paper and the watermark, but it is no longer a Federal Reserve note because it no longer has its value. It is a piece of paper with a strip in it and a watermark. That's what it is.
But under your theory, aren't you redefining the word altered? I mean, under what circumstance would Application Note 3 apply under your theory?
There are many instances of counterfeiting in which an original bill is cut and pasted to appear to be something larger than it is. There are a lot of different sorts of counterfeiting that are out there that involve literally altering a bill. And then this also applies to other types of instruments that are counterfeited, that are bearer instruments. Could be, I'm trying to think of maybe, not a U.S. savings bonds because those are not necessarily bearer. But there are maybe other instruments that would be bearer that it could be applied to the alteration of those. That is some physical alteration to the instrument itself without completely erasing everything on it. And that is what these people were doing, completely erasing everything on it. Judge Stagg looked at that and said, that's no different than printing on Federal Reserve paper, the paper itself, because you are starting with a blank sheet, albeit it has a watermark, but it does not apply to that particular value of a note.
What would you do in a situation in which, a hypothetical situation in which only part of the note was bleached away and other information was somehow imprinted or photocopied on it? Would you take the same position that once part of it is bleached away, it no longer has value?
Well, if part of it is bleached away and it is still recognizable, and there is the testimony from the Agent Kraft that relates to the percentage of the damage or the percentage of the erasure of the indication or indicia of what the value, what the original thing was. If there is enough there and the Treasury is able to determine what its value actually is, then it would be redeemable exchanged for something of full value. But if it is printed over, they will simply forfeit that. They will retain that instrument as counterfeit, and that would be what they would call it, would be counterfeit. They wouldn't necessarily call it an altered instrument. They would call it counterfeit.
Of course, I think the evidence is quite good as to what the Treasury Department would consider these bills to be, which is not, though, that it seems to me, the argument is there, but it seems to me that saying the sentencing guidelines would depend on that is far from clear. What the guideline says is something that has been made or manufactured in its entirety. And I think where you would draw the line, and with the aid of the Treasury Department, is even if the paper is the same, watermark, whatever else, it's the printing. If the printing is gone and totally new printing is on it, that is no longer, what's new on there is no longer made or manufactured in its entirety. Is that a fair summary of where you stand?
I'm sorry, I wasn't following exactly everything that you said. It would be, made in its entirety.
Well, let me restate the question if you weren't following it, and I apologize for being unclear. If the printing is entirely removed, that's when it no longer, what has been put back on it, is no longer, can it be said, has not been. I mean, the argument by the defendants is that so long as the paper is the same, maybe the watermark, I don't know how far they're willing to go, that means that what is new is not made or manufactured in its entirety. You take the opposite position. As soon as all the printing's gone, that becomes a totally new note when more printing is put on it. And that seems to me to be an interpretation call that's not determined by whether the Treasury Department would recognize it or not. It's what are the sentencing guidelines getting to? And can you accept that there at least is a benefit to the, not to use this as a term of art, to the counterfeiter, to use the original paper, to use the watermark, to have paper with the watermark? It provides benefit.
Oh,
to
yes,
the passing of the bill.
It definitely does. It makes counterfeiting, it makes the product superior to any other bond paper that is used. The only way they could be better would be if they got the actual paper that is used at the Treasury Department, but they would still have to get then imprint the watermark on it for the particular bill and get the strip. So that's a give and a take. It's in one sense easier to pass one that has at least some indication of a watermark and a strip on it, because most cashiers who are dealing in cash just see that and they don't look to see that it maybe doesn't match what's printed. But once it's printed in its entirety, it is manufactured in its entirety, and that's what Judge Stagg, I believe, was looking at. And that's the distinction between these two cases and this case, is that we do have testimony that these documents, that in its, during the process, it would no longer be accepted. Therefore, it has lost its identity as a note, and it, when they print on it, they are not altering it. They are counterfeiting and creating a counterfeit note.
So are you taking the position, or does the government take the position that these other two circuit cases are wrongly decided? Or not? Or
hate to disparage another circuit, but they were decided under different facts, and they had different different set of facts were presented to them, and we don't know. I don't know what was argued in Clemma case at all. And Schrecken Ghost, I can imagine that what we are arguing here was argued there, because the basis for the opinion is that, oh, no, it would have been accepted even if it was completely blank. And we have taken that premise out of Schrecken Ghost and said that does not apply here. It would not have been accepted. So Schrecken Ghost is decided on a false premise. In Clemma, I don't know what was argued there.
What are we to make that the sentencing guidelines hasn't done anything about this since 2004?
I'm sorry.
What are we to make about the sentencing guidelines inactivity on this? Those cases were decided in 2004.
That is correct. I have checked with the Sentencing Commission on this, and there is, I understand, some move to look at this again, but I do not know what the result is going to be or if there has been one. I last checked their website right before Christmas, and I'm unaware of what action they have taken, if any, on this particular thing. It's not something that's terribly common, but I believe it's going to become more common because we have had two cases in our district already of this particular technique being used, one with the ammonia and one using Easy-Off oven cleaner to bleach out the bills. So it's becoming a more common use because the advancements in the color printers and also the feel. It's a wonderful, wonderful product that comes out. Also, the originals are in evidence. The judge requested that they be put into evidence, and the exhibits are there. So you will see the entire gamut from some that are partially bleached all the way up through the final product. And the agent did testify, and this relates to the two-level enhancement. The agent testified that two bills, which were printed obviously from the same $100 bill, did make it to a bank, so they were obviously passed. And with respect to the rejection at McDonald's, McDonald's has a sign on their window. They don't accept bills larger than a 20 anyway. So when a $100 bill was handed to the cashier, she had no authority to accept a $100 bill and then had to go to the manager. And in that particular instance, the manager knew one of the defendants in the car and refused to accept the $100 bill from that defendant. So there are other things there other than the quality of the bill that affected its inability to be passed at McDonald's. And when you see the actual counterfeit bills, you will be amazed at how good they are. These are not as good as some from the other case, but they are quite good.
Counsel, your position that there is no conflict between 2B1.1 and 2B5.1?
If you look at the idea, there is no real conflict because you have to find that it's an altered bill before the application note applies. And Judge Stagg expressly said that he did not find that it applied. It's at page 7 of the sentencing. He said, I don't even want to hear about it. It's just simply plain English to me that when you blank out the ink on a piece of paper, it is not then an obligation of the United States. And when you print something on top of it, you have counterfeited the money of the United States. So he did not accept that this was altered. He accepted it as counterfeited because they had taken away every indicia other than those two things and the watermark and the strip and had counterfeited it. So that was he defined counterfeit, and therefore there's no real conflict because of the use of the terms and defining what this object is, this final product.
But do you accept that if it is a counterfeit obligation, it would be guideline sentencing would be under 2B5.1. If it's altered, it would be under 2B1.1. Do you accept that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is what the application note says. But in this case, we are dealing with counterfeit, and alteration is something much less than what was done here, much less. Also, the enhancement for easy to pass is a factual finding, and the district judge did find that it was based on the testimony that two bills had actually been passed, and just the simple knowledge that, and I believe I raised these points in my brief, that the paper is the same, it's going to evade any detection with those little pins that they use, it's going to react the same way. The feel, the tactile quality of the paper is the same. So the likelihood of these counterfeit bills passing is greatly increased because of the process that's used and because of the original document that is used to achieve it.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cashier.
Thank you.
Ms. Winchell, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To clarify a point I made it earlier that Judge Rodriguez that you had asked is whether or not Agent Kraft had testified as to the quality of the note. I had the chance to go through the transcript which we brought with us, and there was no testimony with respect to the quality of the note. In fact, the notes themselves, the physical notes, were actually in Baton Rouge at the time that we had the sentencing hearing. And after I had moved to introduce or have the original notes put into evidence, they had to get down to Baton Rouge in order to be able to place them into the physical record. So the court never actually looked at the physical notes themselves. I think what also needs to be clarified a little bit is when we talk about that there were two passings. Maybe we were a bit wrong about that. It should probably be more attempted passings, because they tried to, Mr. Harris tried to give the $100 bill to McDonald's, but they refused it. There was no testimony at all developed by the government that they refused it because McDonald's doesn't take $100 bills. The manager looked at it and told Mr. Harris, this is a fake $100 bill. So he knew right away, regardless of what counsel has argued about how this is, feels like the real thing, and even though it still has a security threat, it was obvious from the inception, from the appearance of it, that it was not an authentic $100 bill. So with respect to the enhancement provision, the court erred in not even looking at those facts as well as looking at the note itself to determine the physical features of it.
What's your position on those two notes that did make it to a bank?
Our position is that we were not provided or given any evidence by the government, as well as Agent Kraft did not testify as to whether or not those two notes were actually passed at the bank. We don't know if somebody brought them in and the bank looked at it and said, my gosh, these are fake. We will not accept these, but we've got to take these because we're under an obligation to turn them over because we know they've been either altered or they were counterfeit. There's been there was no evidence or testimony developed as to whether or not they were actually counterfeit or if they were these altered instruments that our clients were involved in. So I don't even think the court should have taken those two things, those two notes, into consideration in rendering its decision and applying the enhancement against our client. So with respect to the enhancement provision, that portion of it most definitely needs to be remanded back to the court. If in the event this court should decide that 2B5-1 should apply in this particular case and not 2B1. I also think it's important to let the court know with respect to Agent Kraft's testimony. On page 33 of the transcript, he was asked about this mutilated money or the money that had been possibly bleached. And he had stated that he was asked that if it's determined, if less than 50% of the ink is there on this, they call it mutilated money, would it then be, could you turn it over to the Treasury Department and get another genuine bill replaced? And Agent Kraft testified and said, if it is determined to be a certain value, then they will exchange the note. So even if this was partially bleached, and our clients decided to just turn it over and they hadn't put the $100 on it, if it was just partially bleached and you still could see the 5 or you still could see the 1, the Treasury Department would have replaced it with another note where it was, it was clear, the ink and everything was clear. It also should be noted to the court that even when all of the ink is off of it, it's still genuine currency because it still has its watermark and it still has the threat. And that's still a felony for possessing genuine currency paper. So if you're going to be a counterfeiter and you still steal the actual Crane paper that is used to make our currency, you still can be charged with that as well. So in response to counsel's remark about how this blank note has no value to it. It does because it still maintains the security and the watermark. But in the regards to the court's decision, I think it's important that the court look at application note number 3, follow the guidance in application note number 3, and reverse the trial court and sentence our clients under section 2B1. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Winchell. Your case is under submission. We noticed that you're court appointed, and we wish to thank you for your willingness to take the appointment. You've certainly done a very fine job on behalf of your clients.
Thank you.
Next case, United States versus Wofford.